is a done deal, but the presidential election is still too close to call. Good Wednesday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, millions of ballots have yet to be counted across the country, but we do know who won Florida last night. Give us a call with your thoughts. It's 549-2937. Then later, author Amy West and some good news and notes for your midweek after a tense time. But first this hour, the presidential election is still too close to call this morning. Millions of ballots remain uncounted in a number of key states. What we can tell you for sure is that President Trump last night did win Florida and its 29 electoral votes. At the same time, Jacksonville tilted blue, at least at the top of the ticket, choosing Joe Biden for president, although he did not win the state. Voters here also decided a number of local contests on the ballot, and they approved more money for local schools. Lots to discuss. A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics is covering it all, and he's on the line now with his thoughts. A.G., always good to hear your voice. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let us know your thoughts about the presidential election and all of the local contests on the ballot last night. Give us a call, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and already getting your comments on Facebook. Well, AG, as I said, in a number of states, particularly the key states in the upper Midwest, they are still counting ballots along with over the state line in Georgia. So we're going to have to wait today and tomorrow to see how that shakes out. That said, we did get a decisive result last night in Florida, President Trump winning comfortably. A swing to the right in Miami-Dade County was really striking to look at. And at the same time, it was remarkable to see Jacksonville vote blue for the first time since Jimmy Carter won the presidency. What are your thoughts about how Florida went last night?
Well, it was a good night for the president's campaign and his message against socialism in Florida specifically, especially South Florida. The groundwork for that was laid in 2018 when you saw Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis attacking Andrew Gillum and to a much lesser extent Bill Nelson on so-called socialism. So, that groundwork was laid and it worked out well for the president. President put a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of effort to the state, and he had to because Democrats were dumping a lot of money too, from the forward majority group, which work on down-ballot House races, about $12 million from them. Michael Bloomberg spent $100 million in the state. So they forced the president to defend his position here, which he did. He outperformed most of the polls. He wasn't able to replicate that, it looks like, in the blue wall states of the upper Midwest, the ones that Trump, rather improbably won in 2016. We're seeing votes come in from these urban centers. These votes are going to, by and large, bank Democratic, and you'll see a lot of court challenges. Regarding Duval's performance, yes, Joe Biden won, and that's historic, first time since 1976, but I looked at in a larger context. You've got a Democrat plus 40,000 electorate here. Joe Biden didn't win by 40,000. There's still work to do. And when you look at the differences regarding the outlying counties like St. John's, Clay, Nassau, it was kind of a wash. So in terms of the regional play, there's still work to do for Democrats in this part of the state. And Democrats in the state, writ large, you're seeing Nikki Fried, Anna Eskamani, others calling for a reckoning because last night was a bloodbath for the Democratic Party in the state.
It's 549-2937 to join us. And let's talk about some of the local races on the ballot. John Rutherford beating Donna Deegan in her attempt to oust him from Congress. Al Lawson easily winning re-election. Those were both expected outcomes due to the partisan makeup and, frankly, the gerrymandering of their congressional districts. And then a number of other contests on the ballot. Republicans easily won re-election in all of them. The closest one was the Duval County Clerk of Courts race between Jody Phillips and Jimmy Midyett. That was the only one that seemed to tighten up for a little bit. So what are your thoughts about how all of those races shook out?
Well, I mean, the Clerk of Courts race was really the most interesting to me in some respects because it was a countywide race. You had a really unknown Republican candidate, and you had Midyet, who Jody Phillips's campaign spent more time defining than defining their own candidate. And that place seemed to work with NPAs. It seemed to work with some Democrats. It's about winnowing down the margins, but, you know, it was a good night for that style of campaigning in a down-ballot race. The state House race and the state Senate races in this area, I mean, Travis Hutz and Jennifer Bradley, they had easy wins. You kind of expected that. You know, when I look at what Cord Byrd, Jason Fisher, Clay Yarborough, those people, you know, they had comfortable wins also. And, you know, it was kind of a rising tide lifts all boats. They didn't have to do a lot in these campaigns. Cord Byrd especially won by a huge margin. And, you know, that was after Joshua Hicks ran against him, had a lot of money behind him for a Democratic challenger in a safe seat, had some narrative, had some ability to message, and still got his clock cleaned. So, you know, I think ultimately the Republican Party of Florida created an environment that was favorable for Republicans in this area.
It's 549-2937. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Okay, let's move on to a couple of other matters that voters decided last night, AG, beginning with money for local schools in our area, both in Duval and Clay County. Those half-cent sales tax referendum measures cruised to victory. So for the advocates that had pushed for that for a couple of years, that is a win because we will see improvement and school construction that school advocates had long hoped for, both in public schools and charter schools, which are public schools under state law. They will get their cut of it as well.
It's a win, but it's a provisional win. I mean, this money doesn't all exist at once. It's phased in over time. It's got to be programmed, et cetera. So a lot of these projects that people envision, they're probably going to help somebody else's kids rather than their own if they're thinking their kids are going to be helped by it in a lot of cases. It just takes a while to do capital projects. It takes a while to do this kind of financing. So incrementally over time, it will have its benefit. But it's like so many other infrastructural questions in the city. You know, we create a regressive tax solution, and that solution is a stopgap because, you know, fundamentally, when it comes to millage, we undervalue our properties and we undertax compared to other major areas. And so we have legacy costs in our schools and our pension plans across the board. We don't like to pay as we go.
Yeah. So then what do you think about the fact that Florida voted yes last night on raising the state's minimum wage to $15 an hour? This will be phased in over a period of years. There is, of course, a good chance the legislature might try to obviate those results or throw sand in the gears to prevent that from fully taking effect. They have a tendency to do that with these ballot amendment initiatives. But that's one that seemed to get bipartisan traction.
Yeah, I mean, that did well with NPAs and with Democrats in polling ahead of time. And, you know, the whole question was, is it going to get 60%? It was close until the end. I was tracking the amendments last night, and it was a late night for me.
For a lot of us. Yeah, exactly right.
I thought they'd be wrapped pretty early. So 2018 saw a lot of amendments just kind of pass without any real discussion, and seem like people more circumspect in this election cycle. But, you know, where were the Democrats on this issue? Where was Nikki Fried? You know, where were these leaders who supposedly stand up for these pocketbook issues? They were nowhere to be found. And you have to ask, was it their donations? Was it their political ambitions that kept them quiet on an issue that really was a base issue? And we saw it before with medical marijuana, where Democrats are largely absent. On felon right restoration, I don't know if Democrats as much as they could on that either. They tend to see these issues, they can't get through the legislature, and they back away from the citizen initiative part. And you know, it's kind of interesting when you look at these two parties in the state. You look at the Alberta's vote amendment that failed, the one that would open primaries in some races. Republicans and Democrats, they fight about everything, but my gosh, they love that two-party system, don't they?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay, let me go to some calls now as we speak with A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. Let us know how you feel about last night's election. And again, we need to stress the presidential election is still not decided. We do know who won Florida, though. 549-2937. DJ in Avondale. Hi, DJ. Good morning.
Hi, thanks so much.
Sure.
I've appreciated the discussion a lot. I guess I'm just wondering if either of you have any insight as to why locally and statewide the party tended to target the safe Republican seats and seem to leave some of the closer races like House District 15 over here in my side of town, or even the city council special election, seemed like they could have used more investment and maybe flipped those races.
Okay, thanks for that, DJ. Yeah, House District 15 was Wyman Duggan against Tamiat Thomas, AG. That was seen as a possibly flippable seat to the Democrats. Mr. Duggan did keep his seat there. And then the city council race with Nicole Hamm, the Democratic challenger, losing to Mr. Carrico. What about DJ's point? Could those races have used more resources, or would it not have made a difference?
I think you have to separate them because it's really two different operations. The House District 15 race with Thomas, she had an outside help, and we talked about it a couple minutes ago, Forward Majority, a group that Robert Kennedy, the representative in the Kennedy Siam is associated with, dumped a lot of money into state house races in the state. It's just they couldn't convert. And I think part of the problem they had was the collateral was uninspiring. I got a mailer from them, and it was like reading 96 Theses. Nobody's reading that. So there were resources behind Thomas. They were just misdirected. The Republican Party of Florida hit NPAs, hit female Democrats hard with the negative stuff about Thomas, defining her. And I think that's where you saw your margins, really. In 15, you've got a schism between Democrats that hasn't been fully resolved. We saw in 2018, Tracy Polson can give me over because she underperformed in black precincts in 2020. I think that's the truth with Tamiat Thomas in Avondale and Ortega and these places. She didn't have the margin she needed with NPAs and, you know, so on. In City Council District 4, that was a machine campaign, ultimately. I mean, Kevin Carrico, he was pretty quiet. It was a pretty by-the-numbers campaign, but he managed to hit Nicole Hamm on, you know, being so-called anti-police, so-called pro-Antifa, these things that got out there. And, you know, that kind of messaging knocks Democrats off their game. Democrats want to be taken at face value on their positions. They want to be seen as moderate and reassuring and reasonable. And what the Tim Baker Republican style does is it knocks them on their butts. And they haven't figured it out in how many election cycles now. But it is the question looming over local politics. Democrats, despite having numerical advantages in a lot of the city, they lose the messaging war still.
Right. It is remarkable to look at, considering, as we've been discussing, it is trending blue in this city. Doug emails the show, please point out that the demographic changes don't just apply to Duval County, but also Clay, St. John's, and Nassau. They trended more Democratic last night, although Republicans won overall. The white population is growing, according to the census, but the Hispanic and Asian populations are growing faster. He's referencing a tweet from Andrew Pantazzi of the Times Union, looking at some of the data. Okay, let's go to Lisa in St. Augustine. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask about the Sullivan court decision with the post office processing mail, especially as it relates to the South Florida post offices being affected. Because I lost track of, I know that they didn't follow his ruling, and I wondered what impact that had.
Thank you, Lisa. Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. AG, that is something to watch today. U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan yesterday ordered the U.S. Postal Service to be prepared to discuss their apparent lack of compliance with a court order, ordering them to sweep up any lingering ballots from around the country, get them to be counted, and that includes ballots in South Florida. Now, apparently there were 300,000 around the country in multiple locations that were left on the post office floors. I don't think that would be enough, probably, to change the outcome in Florida, but it is something to watch today to see how that shakes out in court.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything there that's going to shake this margin. I mean, it was a 3-point win for Trump. That's a landslide in the state. You know, and I think you could see some work around the margins there, but you're going to see a long season of legal challenges. You know, something the president has basically said already. The lawyers are going to Pennsylvania. He pretty much declared victory in the middle of the night last night. We're going to see a lot of legal stuff.
Exactly. And I want to, you're right, he did declare victory. Let us be clear. The president has not won the election. We don't know the winner yet.
Don't kick me off Twitter for saying this stuff.
Exactly right. A tweet from Nate Cohn at the New York Times letting us know that Joe Biden has just taken the lead in Michigan, according to the Associated Press, along with Arizona, Nevada, and Wisconsin. Biden now leads in states worth 270 electoral votes. That's the number needed to win. We'll watch it through the day, but let's take a few more calls. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan.
Yes, one of the callers was asking why the Democratic Party didn't give more money to some of the local races. So I was hoping, I don't know if y'all can talk about today or maybe for a future show, to have some of the leaders of the Democratic Party in and discuss that, because it doesn't seem like the place to place blame to me, because looking at an article that was in the Times Union about Jason Fisher claiming transparency, if you look through all the donations that he gets a lot of money from super PACs, and it's hard to follow exactly who's giving him that money. My guess is that a lot of the charter school industry is giving him a lot of money. He was the one that co-sponsored the bill that's forcing us to give part of our sales tax money to charter schools, and Chartrans charter school has already applied for a $23 million loan, which I assume he's going to use our sales tax money to build a brand new charter school. So if we had been able to vote on that sales tax referendum in 2019, they wouldn't be getting right off the bat $23 million for a brand new school, when what we wanted with our sales tax referendum was to repair the aging school. So anyway, my general questions is about money and politics.
Okay, yeah. Money and politics, thank you, Susan, in Mandarin there. Money and politics is not just a Florida-centric phenomenon, but AG, dark money in this state is highly influential and controversial. Susan certainly is following this at a granular level, but of course you are too, and have for many years. And so what are your thoughts about how she brought this whole phenomenon of money and politics down to our local level when it comes to the half-cent sales tax push for schools?
Well, there are a number of things in play there, and I think she brought up a couple of good points. The national super PAC money comes in on the Democratic side, but, you know, candidates like Jason Fisher and other state House candidates, they benefit from a lot of institutional money inside the state of Florida through political committees. And as you know, having looked at a political committee finance, that money can be very fungible and transitory. It can move from one committee to the next, to the next, to the next. And the only people who really know the source of it are the accountants. And that's something that is legal currently, and is probably going to stay legal for the next decade, given the way reapportionment is going to look in the state. But, you know, regarding the programming of the sales tax money, I think the caller illustrates there's going to be a lot of discussions. There's going to be a lot of food fights and a lot of speculation about spends that go on charters. because even though all the professionals say charter schools are public schools, et cetera, there are a lot of people out there who don't feel that way. So this is going to be a flashpoint issue for the next decade.
Certainly will. Here is a tweet from Jane West. The St. Johns County Democratic Party gave my campaign $500 for the St. Augustine Port Waterway and Beaches Commission, and I won 55% to 44%. So they do support local races, she says. Jane, thanks for that. On our Facebook page, people having a lively discussion. Jim writes, how is it that Joe Biden won red Duval but lost Florida? Trump scared Latino voters in South Florida with the socialism boogeyman, and they bought it. Go
Duval
ahead, AG.
Not red. Duval is 40,000 vote Democratic advantage. It's a plurality. I mean, just because the Democratic Party gave the mayor's office to Lenny Curry in 2019 doesn't mean Duval is red. It performs red because Democrats have underperformed here. If you've got a 40,000 vote advantage, harvest it. You can't blame the Dixiecrats anymore. They're all dead or Republican now.
It will be interesting to see where the local Democratic Party goes from here.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a comment on Facebook from Theodorus. Georgia wants to stop counting votes because they don't like the result. That's fraud. Well, you know what, Theodorus? They're still counting up in Georgia, and that is one of many states that is still too close to call. Valerie writes, you know, I think a lot of people voted Trump for one reason only, abortion. We'll have to see what the data shows when people share a little bit more about their vote, Valerie, but thanks for your comment there. 549-2937. Mike is in Bay Meadows. Mike, good morning.
Hey, how you doing, Melissa?
All right.
I was just wondering how come no one's really talking about Amendment 1. It seems that, you know, Florida is comprised of a lot of immigrants, and the immigration process is, you know, it's expansive. So I just want to know, how does this play out to the future of voting in
mm-hmm.
Florida?
Sure. Let's talk about these ballot amendments, AG. We mentioned Amendment 2, the minimum wage amendment. That made it through, but Amendment 1 and several others did not.
I mean, when you look at the amendments, I mean, Amendment 4 didn't make it through because of the pass it twice amendment. That was one I was watching. Republicans wanted that one. What was the number on Amendment 1? Remind me.
I'm looking it up right now. I'm frantically typing as you talk. let's see. Election results. What Florida amendments passed? Hang on a minute here. Let's see. Amendment 1, the citizenship amendment, it did pass.
Yeah, it did.
That was my error. Yeah, it passed.
Yeah.
And that's the citizenship amendment.
Keep that queued up because I lost my power right before the call.
It passed by 79%. That one overwhelmingly passed. Amendment 2 passed by just over the line, 61%. The open primary amendment, Amendment 3, did not make it. It only got 57% approval. So that gives you an idea of the first three.
Yeah, thank you. The citizenship amendment, that's a seemingly semantic change that people kind of signed off on. And it's going to, you know, require people to actually prove citizenship to vote rather than residency. I think that will, you know, help Republicans some in the margins. We'll see what it really does. The Amendment 3, all voters vote, that was one that had, that would have eliminated primaries in today's sense for some of the top offices in the state. But it was something that Republicans honestly killed that one because that was polling worse with Republicans than with Democrats and independents.
Yeah, and then Amendment 4, which would have made it harder for citizens to get ballot amendments even before the voters, that did not pass.
Yeah, and that was another attempt to basically undermine the amendment process. We see that from Republicans periodically. You know, it wasn't enough that they raised it at a 60% threshold in 2006. It's, well, no, you got to pass it twice because you might not have known what you passed the first time, which, you know, it's an insulting proposition to voters on its face, and voters rejected it, I think, as a result. But that doesn't mean we won't see it back again at some point.
That's right. Let's take a few more calls as we talk about last night's election results, which, once again, I'll remind folks, the presidential election is still yet to be decided. 549-2937, Terry in Lakewood. Hi, Terry.
Hi, good morning. I know we don't know how the election's going to pan out yet, but for the independents here locally, what are some steps we can take to maybe see a valid third-party candidate in the future?
And I assume you are an MPA, Terry?
Yeah.
Yeah. AG, let's talk about that, because MPAs like Terry make up a solid third of Florida voters. We've got about a third Democrat, a third Republican, and a third MPA in this state.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough road for third-party candidates. I mean, the road to any party's organization is ground up. And until you see libertarians, greens, whatever, running for local offices and winning in numbers, it's hard to build that kind of structure, especially with the kind of money that's coming into these campaigns, corporatist interests on the Republican and Democratic sides both, dumping huge amount of money on the top. So it's very difficult for a third party, period. I mean, and that's something we saw on this ballot versus 2016. 2016, you saw something of viable third parties. I mean, Gary Johnson had a pulse. Jill Stein was there. And that cut some of the margins, and that made some differences in some races. And this time around, it was basically a binary choice. Trey Jorgensen, the libertarian, got like 1% in some places. But those margins, I think, ultimately helped Joe Biden. And there's probably a postmortem to be written down the road by somebody looking at that data and in those Rust Belt states, the blue wall states, that will point to that. But, you know, without third-party candidates, it's like you see more polarization, and that will destroy this election cycle.
Always so great to get your insights, and I know it's been a long night and more long days ahead this week, so thanks for swinging by our little corner of the world and sharing your thoughts. We really appreciate it, AG.
Appreciate it. See you soon.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics, and much more still ahead. Later, some good news and notes for your week are What's Good Wednesdays. A new climate report is out for Florida. Author Amy West, and up next.
Florida faces some of the worst potential impacts from climate change, and it's a little bit exciting to be discussing the ways that we can potentially forestall some of those impacts.
It is a landmark new report on reversing the impacts of climate change and what that means for Florida. We'll be right back.
Twenty years ago, election night turned into election month.
A lot of the television networks started saying, we project Al Gore the winner in Florida.
The state of Florida and its 25 electoral votes.
And knowing everything else we knew, that was making it kind of look like a big sweep.
Bush v. Gore revisited, with lessons for now. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Saturday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Robert Scott. I've been a sustaining supporter of WJCT for over 10 years now. I listen to WJCT all the time, and I have since I was a young adult. One of my favorite shows is actually a local show, and that's First Coast Connect. One of the great values, I think, is listeners are invited to call in. By the end of the hour, I'm definitely more informed about an issue. It's also made me think about it a lot deeper than I probably would have. This is WJCT News 89.9.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9. Welcome back. Well, the U.S. officially exited the landmark Paris Climate Agreement this week. Bad news for advocates working to reduce carbon emissions that contribute to climate change. At the same time, a new report is out called the 350 PPM Pathways for Florida. What's that mean? Well, it outlines the pathways to reduce pollution to achieve 350 PPM or parts per million. That's the scientific definition of how we stabilize the climate. I spoke with report author Ben Haley and attorney Julia Olson. She's representing young people across the country and here in Florida, suing the government over its inaction on climate change. Take a listen. Julia, Ben, good to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Ben, I'd like to start with you. You're the author of this report, which I think is of interest to the entire country, but particularly our listeners here in Florida, where you look at the pathways to reduce pollution, to stabilize the climate and avert the worst impacts of climate change. That is of great interest in our coastal state. Can you give us a look at some of the top findings in the report, which would be of most interest to Florida listeners?
Sure. Well, as you said, Florida faces some of the worst potential impacts from climate change, and it's a little bit exciting to be discussing the ways that we can potentially forestall some of those impacts, if you will. And, you know, we conducted this report for Florida, charting out a deep decarbonization pathway. We've done this all over the country in different regions, and basically, you know, we've come to similar conclusions that it basically is technically and economically feasible. And some of the interesting conclusions specifically for the state of Florida revolve basically around its resource endowments. And when I say that, I mean, you know, what resource advantages does Florida have versus other places in the country to decarbonize its economy? And unsurprisingly, one of the great resources it has is solar. And solar really kind of forms the backbone of the decarbonized economy in Florida. It provides, you know, the majority of electricity in the long term. So, you know, we see huge deployment of solar, and that can be, you know, on land or on rooftops, so it can be distributed as well. And you combine that with, you know, biomass resources in Florida as well. And really that forms kind of the basis of a decarbonized economy where, you know, right now almost all of the energy that Florida uses and consumes is from fossil sources. So, you know, the deployment of solar, the use of biomass, and really the electrification of transportation. So all those vehicles that burn gasoline now, in the future, they really have to run on electricity. And all of that is possible and economical, really, with the technology advancements that we've seen over the last 5 or 10 years. All of it is becoming more and more kind of a reasonable proposition as we look into the future.
So the argument you're making in this report is that it's not too expensive to decarbonize, that whether we choose clean energy or dirty energy, we're spending trillions of dollars, so that we might as well make the transition to decarbonization. I want to ask you as a follow-up, for many years, people in Florida have said, why aren't we seeing a more aggressive push to solar here in the Sunshine State, along with some of the other changes that you mentioned? And the answer is special interests have really put a stranglehold on that in Tallahassee, our state capital. What are your thoughts about the politics of navigating this kind of transition in a state like Florida?
Well, like any huge transition, it has to get some momentum and it has to get started. And really costs and some of the technology advancements that we've seen over the last couple of years are making the arguments of special interests far less compelling. You know, when we're really on the border in terms of competitiveness between fossil sources and renewable sources, it's easier to kind of stall that progress by, you know, making conventional wisdom arguments that decarbonized energy is necessarily more expensive and things like that. You know, but as we've seen, you know, some of the precipitous cost declines, those arguments are really going to start falling on deaf ears. And obviously, you can stall progress for a limited amount of time, but the future is coming. And I think eventually, you know, utilities start to understand that. You know, we saw a very similar thing, you know, across the country with utilities sort of keeping coal plants online. But they have since become so uneconomic to maintain that we've started to see the retirement of those. And so really the deployment of renewables, I would expect, follows a similar trajectory. where there's a bit of inertia in the system, special interests kind of stall that progress, but eventually the story becomes so compelling that they're not able to keep sort of their finger in the dike, if you will, and that technology sort of floods the market. I would anticipate that happens in Florida, but of course you have to keep pushing politically as well, because we don't really have time to wait necessarily. Sort of every day counts, every month counts, every year counts, and so we need to kind of overcome those barriers as fast as possible.
And the argument young people are making is lending a lot of urgency to that, Julia. Julia Olson with Our Children's Trust. Now, you've been heading up youth lawsuits around climate across the country, including some young people here in Florida. They are trying to convince adults basically to do the right thing, to give them a viable future. Tell us a little bit more about this work.
Thanks for asking. Yeah, these cases that our Children's Trust helps lead and support, including the case in Florida, are fundamentally about the constitutional rights of young people under both state and our U.S. Constitution to rights to life and liberty and the underlying resources that are indispensable to our lives and our freedoms. And so in Florida, the case is brought directly under Article 10 of the Florida Constitution and Article 1, which protect Floridians' rights to life and also to public trust resources. So resources like air and water and our coastlines and oceans that are fundamental to our lives. And when Ben talks about, you know, the impediments to really transitioning our energy system, one enormous impediment are a system of laws and policies and practices that governments have put in place that favor fossil energy over other forms of energy. And so getting government to no longer favor fossil energy and undo that system and create a new system that allows for this transition towards electricity really powering our energy systems in a clean way is what we're trying to seek through this lawsuit, holding government accountable to abide by its constitutional duty to children and future generations.
And how many children are you representing around the country, including the child in Florida? He lives south of Jacksonville, I believe, down in Indian River County.
Yeah, so Levi is one of the Florida plaintiffs, and he is now 13 years old. He was 11 at the time the Florida case was filed. And we represent 8 young people in Florida. We represent 21 young people suing the U.S. government. But in total right now, I think we're representing about 90 young people across the United States as plaintiffs, and also plaintiffs in Canada and Mexico and some other jurisdictions outside of the U.S.
And what's the status of the lawsuit on behalf of these young people right now?
So Levi and his other plaintiffs in Florida had argued first in front of Circuit Judge Kevin Carroll in Leon County, and Judge Carroll dismissed their case, saying that these are political issues and the separation of powers of the three branches of government precludes the court from getting involved. And so the case is now up on appeal, and what the young people are arguing is, you know, number one, many of these youth don't have rights to vote. And number two, majoritarian politics can never undo constitutional rights. And it's actually emphatically the job of the courts to step in and tell the other branches of government, your conduct is unconstitutional because it's depriving these children of their livelihoods, their health, their safety, and their homes in some cases.
Okay, and as that lawsuit makes its way, Ben Haley, getting back to the report, you argue that in the end, it will cost more to delay and not take decisive action. What's your argument to people who they're listening to this and they increasingly are, most Americans are now on board with the reality of climate change and the need to address it, but they have not really absorbed what you're putting forth in the report, which is that if we do nothing or if we delay, it will end up costing more than if we take action.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we have always studied this kind of in the way people have thought about it, which is, you know, how much does it cost to decarbonize our energy system? And ultimately, those costs are compared to the potential benefits for preventing some of the worst impacts from climate change. We are now in a paradigm where, you know, it's very possible that by 2050, we're really happy that we decarbonize our energy system only on a cost basis. So basically what I'm saying is, you know, a fossil energy system in 2050 is very possible that that energy system costs more than a decarbonized one does. And so what that means is, irregardless of the climate benefits, it may be the prudent decision just economically, right? And so we already know and we already understand that those climate impacts have been accelerated even from some of the worst prognostications, and the ultimate economic impacts of those are going to be hugely material, and they're going to show up earlier than we sort of thought. And so, you know, you're now in a situation where, you know, the cost may be equal or less, and the benefits of doing that are, you know, huge, and really, to be completely honest, almost unmodelable, unanalyzable. Just, it's almost, you almost have to take the sort of perspective of insurance, because basically the risk is so large, it's difficult to analyze, right? But we, you know, conventional wisdom has taken a little bit of time to catch up. And one of the things that hasn't caught up to quite yet is the fact that these new technologies ultimately may render our energy system cheaper in the long term. We don't have to continue paying a premium for the added benefits of reducing climate change impacts and the added benefits of air pollution and all the other things that come with sort of the energy system of the future, if you will, versus the energy system of the past. And you know, it's just becoming more and more compelling as we move forward along these technology trajectories. So,
all right, and I want to thank you both for sharing your insights about the new report, the 350 ppm Pathways for Florida report. Author Ben Haley from Evolved Energy with us, along with attorney Julia Olson from Our Children's Trust. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
More still to come in a moment. A conversation with author Amy West. Also, a look at what's good on our news menu this Wednesday. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
At Vistar, members can think outside the branch and manage their accounts whenever they want by using the Vistar app. Check balances, make transfers, payments, check deposits, and more. Info at vistarcu.org. Vistar Credit Union, insured by NCUA.
foreign powers that want to meddle with the election are...
Reporters for the World look beyond our borders.
I've been speaking with a few people inside Iran about
how... Presidents of Guatemala, Honduras, Bolivia...
Next time on The World, global reaction to the U.S. election.
Actually, here in the U.K., in our last general election... just
All eyes on the U.S., on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, how our electoral system has been holding up after the polls closed. We talk with Barton Gellman, whose article, The Election That Could Break America, is about how the pandemic, a deluge of mail-in ballots, slowed postal delivery, voter suppression, lawsuits, and the president himself could affect the outcome. Join us.
Today at 12, here on WJCT News 89.9.
We can now start to take stock after an election for the history books. Only we're leaving the magic wall to others. Instead, we're asking you to paint us a picture on what's changed where you live. I'm Jen White. Join me for the latest on what we do know and on what we don't. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's your chance to learn all about this city's hidden gems and off-the-beaten-path attractions and get them off your bucket list. Author and influencer Amy West takes us on a tour of the First Coast. It's all in her new book, 100 Things to Do in Jacksonville Before You Die. Take a listen.
Amy West, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Okay, so let's get into this book, 100 Things to Do in Jacksonville Before You Die, which is a great title. And this is really a comprehensive list and some hidden gems around town that you've researched in your book. Tell us how this project came together.
You know, I really tried to hone in on the most iconic, legendary, and multi-generational items. It's kind of a culmination of my experience writing and covering Jacksonville over the last decade. And my publisher, Reedy Press, they actually do these books in all the major markets. So a nice little fun tip is you can actually go straight to their website, Reedy Press, and you can, if you're traveling somewhere, you can find these books for those places, Orlando, New York, wherever. So they thought that it was time that Jacksonville had one of their books, and I was so happy to oblige.
Okay, and as we read through this book, we really learn a lot about Jacksonville, even for people that have lived here a long time. Yeah?
Yes, absolutely. And I really wanted to do Jacksonville justice. I wanted to do two things. One, I wanted to show people who kind of are pessimistic about what's out there for Jacksonville, that we are a rich, multicultural city. And then for the people that are major fans of Jacksonville, I really wanted to represent us well. So I wanted to cover those iconic things that people know must be included, but I also wanted to dig up some things that are very kind of essential for this region or for the South or for Florida and include them as well. So there's some fun hidden gems like Sally that makes the robots, animatronics in there, or the Brumos Collection, which now is its own standalone museum that maybe people wouldn't think about, but then the iconic things like the Jacksonville Zoo or the Museum of Contemporary Art, they're all in there.
Okay, what are some other hidden gems we learn about in the book?
I think, you know, I have to give a little mention, a little pause and a mention for events, because I know that due to COVID, we haven't been able to do many of them, and a lot of them have been canceled. But one of them is the, it's the Porch Fest in Springfield.
Uh-huh.
And that one, I think, is such a great event because it's free. It's bringing the community together in a historic neighborhood that maybe if they didn't have an excuse to cross town and go to, now they have an excuse to. It's celebrating local musicians. And it's just a great family fun event. Another great one would be Ash's Boutique and Tea Room. And I actually have an event with them Saturday, November 7th, where we're doing a little tea and you can get a book. But I just love that, the little spot. It's kind of in what I call the shabby chic district of the beaches. It's this elegant little tea room, and she has a boutique in there as well. She's an artist, and she makes these hand-drawn charcoal drawings, and she puts them on clothing. And it's just a very kind of fundamental neighborhood local spot that I thought deserved some light shed on it.
And, of course, you're known for travel. Your website is Amy West Travel. This is a time when we can't really travel as much, so it's a good time to check out attractions in our own backyard.
Yes, absolutely. More than ever. You know, I submitted this manuscript April 1st, right as lockdown started. And there was a lot of, wow, what's going to happen? A lot of concern for the businesses included. My heart went out to them because many of them were struggling. And honestly, at the end of the day, it ended up being the best thing to come out right now because people are looking for things to do in their backyard. They are looking for ways to support local businesses and to just reinvigorate the community that we have. And so I'm very happy that now we have a chance. You know, you have this great list of things to do and a reason for people to explore our backyard. Because we live where people vacation, so we really should do everything we possibly can to experience and explore our community.
That's right. So check it out. It's out now as local author and travel expert Amy West reveals the city's most iconic and unique destinations in her new book. It's 100 Things to Do in Jacksonville Before You Die, a great new guidebook to the city. Check it out wherever books are sold. Amy West, always good to hear your voice. Hope to see you in person the next time as we get through this crazy situation we're all in. Thanks so much.
I agree. Thank you, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Amy will be signing copies of her book at Ashes Boutique and Tea Room in Jacks Beach this Saturday from 10:30 to noon. Open to the public, but reserve a ticket. And some more good news and notes from your week in our What's Good Wednesdays. Are you a vet in need of a job? CareerSource Northeast Florida is hosting Paychecks for Patriots, a statewide virtual hiring event. Log on to their website from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. tomorrow. Still tense from the election? Consider attending a free yoga session in downtown Jacks Saturday at James Weldon Johnson Park. This is from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Namaste, everybody. And support the local nonprofit Beaches Go Green as they host a community cleanup at the Beaches Town Center this Saturday from 8 to 10 a.m. Look out for their tent, wear a mask, socially distance, and help clean up the town center and get it ready for the holidays. Kids can earn community service hours with this, too. And kudos to the Mandarin Garden Club celebrating their 75th anniversary Sunday. They'll be having their annual craft fair Sunday. Kudos, Mandarin. Want more good news delivered to your inbox? Subscribe to our free weekly newsletter, What's Good Wednesdays, at WJCT.org. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for listening. Again, keep it here on 89.9 as we track the election results today. Also on PBS NewsHour this evening as several states remain up in the air. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.